Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today, this July 3rd, for this Tax Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on August 7th, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the questions box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you and when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order of when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted and you will now be able to speak to the rest of you. So that's if you want to join us live on the call. A lot of you are submitting your questions in that question box themselves, and I welcome that. So please go ahead and do that. I can see that some of you have already begun to do that as well. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource, both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar, learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And also, as another reminder, the members, VIP members of the TaxResolutionInstitute.org site get priority on these questions when they get submitted. So the first round of questions here are submitted directly by members. So if you're interested in guaranteeing to get your questions answered, look us up online and check out the membership program that we have available to you. So let's go ahead and get started, Norman. The first one here is Susie. Susie's a member, and she's a CPA. It looks like we're going to dive right into criminal investigation. Her question is, I have a client that has serious delinquent tax liability, over $200,000. He has neglected to file some returns, was audited for a few that he did file, and had additional taxes assessed. He is concerned that the IRS will come after him and put him in jail. Can you explain when the IRS refers to criminal investigation department?
Sure. So criminal investigation is pretty rare, and it's only on cases where the taxpayer either filed a fraudulent return or attempted to avoid and evade taxes. Filing a return which shows a balance due and not being able to pay that balance is not criminal. Not filing the return could go either way. Filing a fraudulent return and concealing income is criminal. So in this case, if the audit, it's not clear here if the audit, sorry. So the audit was taken on the returns that he did file, and it's not clear if the additional taxes assessed were allowed or not, and if they were additional taxes were assessed because the auditor found additional income that wasn't reported, or whether or not the taxpayer had expenses that were disallowed that resulted in higher taxes. So that matters. As to the returns that haven't been filed, he may want to think about filing those returns. I would order wage and income transcripts from the IRS and see for those years that have unfiled returns what the IRS shows in terms of W-2s or 1099s. There may not be a filing enforcement. In other words, there may not have been enough income reported to require returns. So sometimes returns that aren't filed can stay that way because they're not required to if they're below the minimum. So I wouldn't really be too concerned unless there's something more than what you're writing about coming after him and putting him in jail. But I would look about filing those unfiled returns, and I would set up a payment plan for the amount of tax that is owed, the $200,000. If it's with ACS, you'd need a 433F. If it gets assigned to a revenue officer, you would need a 433A. So the two things I would do immediately would be to order wage and income transcripts for the years with unfiled returns and to prepare some kind of financial statement, either an F or an A, to determine the taxpayer's ability to pay the delinquent taxes.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Susie, hopefully that answers your question. Again, as a member, if you need a follow-up to Norman's answer now, you can always schedule a consultation with him directly. Moving on to the next member, this is Angie. And Angie gave us some detail here before she asked her question. So let me get right through that, Norman. A client retained me to file 2016 head of household return after a estranged spouse already filed married filing jointly fraudulently without client signature. He also used three dependents' social security numbers. He was incarcerated at the time, so he had someone from the outside prepare for him. The married filing joint resulted in $19,000 refund, to which we marked void and sent back to the IRS, apparently per the IRS's instructions. I then filed head of household, which resulted in the $7,000 refund. IRS then denied claim, saying client already filed joint and can only file one return. Problem per IRS regarding head of household is number one, since already received itemized return, married filing joint, then denied standard deduction, the IRS suggested return for married filing separate from head of household. They denied the dependent exemption since client needs to show children live with her, school out in the summer, no lease in her name yet, still living in joint home, which was foreclosed later in the year. So, Angie, I'm not sure if you're saying there that the dependents did or did not live with your client, so that's unclear. But there was no formal separation agreement, only restraining order dated 7/10/16. So only showed less than 6 months living apart. They denied the additional child care credit. IRS adjusted return for 2016 now shows client owes $13,000. So that's a big swing in the opposite direction. Client earned only $29,000 in 2016. That amount includes the penalties and interest. The spouse went to jail for embezzlement in August of 2016. Schedule A of fraudulent married filing joint return now shows greater than 50% in charitable deductions, includes his income only. IRS suggests amending the married filing joint return, but if ever audited, this will be a bigger problem for the client. So your question, Angie, is do you think the taxpayer's advocate can help?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of ways to go here. One would be the taxpayer advocate. The other and I'm not sure if it would work or not. I've had it go both ways, and that is filing innocent spouse relief. These innocent spouse is usually based on a return that the taxpayer signed. But in this case, the taxpayer didn't sign the original return. I guess the husband signed her name for her. So she may not qualify for innocent spouse relief, but it may still result in having the liability erased from her portion of the return. She may or may not get the refund, though.
So I think that's the question. Ideally, she was supposed to file head of household claiming the three dependents, and the IRS is not allowing her to do that. If she did that, she was going to get a $7,000 refund for herself. But the spouse...
Right, but the thing is that... they're right in the sense that only one parent can claim the children as dependents. So if the husband did, they're saying that it's
right.
But the thing is, but the husband filed a fraudulent return. So you would think that that would wipe it out. The other thing is that once a married filing joint return is filed, you can't amend it as to head of household or married filing separate. You can do it the other way around. You can, if you originally filed separately, you can amend the return to make it a joint return. But you can't amend a joint return to make it a separate return. So the IRS is right in the sense that you can't amend a married filing joint return into head of household because that's a separate return. But if the original return was fraudulent, then it seems like that wouldn't apply. So I think I would start, I guess it really doesn't matter where you start. I would either contact a taxpayer advocate or look into doing innocent spouse relief. Now, the thing is, are they attempting to collect the $13,000 that they now say she owes or not? Because usually the taxpayer advocate will only get involved if there's a collection involved and the taxpayer collecting against the taxpayer would be an undue burden. So I don't know if it's actively being collected or not, but you might want to contact a taxpayer advocate, or you might want to submit for innocent spouse relief. That's about all I can think of. The other thing is, if he went to jail in August of 2016, then obviously the 2016 return was filed in 2017 while he was incarcerated. I think I would get some kind of proof of that he was incarcerated at the time.
Right. And then I have a follow-up question here from Irving regarding this. Shouldn't the taxpayer file a Form 911 together with the request for innocent spouse? In other words, taxpayer advocate.
No, I don't think I would do one or the other. Okay. I wouldn't do both at the same time.
Got it. All right, Angie. Hopefully that gives you some direction there to help you with this case. Again, you can always use your consultation time to schedule a call with Norman if you have further questions.
I think if you do the innocent spouse relief, they're going to tell you to go to the taxpayer advocate. And if you go to the taxpayer advocate, they're going to suggest that you file it as a spouse relief, frankly. But you got to start somewhere. So I would start wherever you're more comfortable.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Anthony. Anthony's also a member, and he's asking, with regards to an in-business offers and compromise, can you explain how this would work for a company with payroll tax problems? The company still has not been able to make their estimated tax payments for this year and continue to struggle. I want to be able to get them clear of their past liabilities so that they don't go under.
Yeah, so the problem is the IRS takes payroll tax liability very seriously, especially the trust fund portion. So it doesn't say whether or not the trust fund portion has been assessed against responsible persons or not. Also, it doesn't say what form the company is. Is it a corporation, a sole proprietorship, an LLC? But the thing with an in-business offer and compromise is the grounds are that you have to be in current compliance. So if they're not in compliance, if you say that they're still not able to make their estimated tax payments, then they really don't qualify for an in-business offer and compromise. And, I mean, the IRS would rather see them out of business than stay in business and pyramiding the payroll tax liability. So the number one thing that they need to do if they're going to stay in business and if they deserve to stay in business is that they stay current and they, I don't know how many employees they have or what their payroll is, but they need to make federal tax deposits as required, whether that's once a month or following every payroll. So whatever their requirements are, they need to make their federal tax deposits timely and when they file their quarterly returns not owe. So we just finished the second quarter. So at least I would draw a line in the sand and say, okay, now that we're starting the third quarter, that from July 1st, all federal tax deposits will be timely made. The second quarter 941 is due at the end of this month. So they should pay it if they can. If they can't, that could be part of the offer, but they need to stay current from now on. And I think usually the IRS wants you to be current for at least 2 quarters before they'll consider an in-business offer. So they need to get in compliance and stay in compliance for at least 2 quarters.
All right. It looks like a tough road ahead for that client, Anthony. So good luck with that. Moving on to the next member. This is Lindsay. Lindsay's asking, I'm reviewing my client's IRS account transcripts to try and determine when the statute for collection expires. Can you discuss the most common tolling events when calculating this? I think they are nearing the end, but the IRS just levied the client's bank account.
Okay, so first of all, the statute is 10 years from the date of assessment, and that's 10 years from the date of each assessment. So some years may have more than one assessment. There may be one assessment based on the filed return, and then there may have been an audit assessment or some additional assessment of liability. So you need to look at that. And then you need to look at whether there were any tolling events that stopped the clock. The most common would be if the taxpayer requested a collection due process hearing, if there was a bankruptcy, if the taxpayer was out of the country for more than 6 months, if there was a tax court petition filed, if there was anything that stops collection, was there an offer? Is there an offer submitted? And was there a request for an installment agreement submitted? So the time in an installment agreement does not toll, but the time between when you request an installment agreement and when that installment agreement is accepted is tolled, or if it's denied, it's tolled when it's from when it's submitted to 30 days after it's rejected. Another easy way is when you call the IRS and ask for transcripts, also ask them when's the CSET, and they'll be glad to tell you. Also, you may have a program like we do that orders transcripts for us and prepares a report, and the report prepares a CSET analysis. So you may have some kind of software like that that does it for you. But generally, it's 10 years from the date of assessment, and it's tolled for anything that would normally stop collection like an appeal or a bankruptcy or an offer.
That's right. All right. And yes, Norman, we do use software. There's a lot of software companies out there that are doing similar things. The one that we use is Canopy, and Canopy's worked very well for us. So you might want to look into that. All right, Lindsay, hopefully that answered your question. Moving on to Miriam. Miriam is asking, client had an audit for tax year 2014 and ignored the notices. She has now received collection notices for a tax due. NIL has been issued and not sure if we can appeal the audit now. Looking at the original request for information, it seems like we can prove at least some of the expenses they were looking at. What are my options?
Yeah, so the normal timeline for that kind of stuff is there's an audit, and then the auditor issues a report, and the taxpayer has 30 days to get back to the auditor disputing it. And based on that, the auditor may or may not alter their report. If they don't, then they issue a notice of deficiency. The notice of deficiency gives the taxpayer 60 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court. If a petition isn't filed within the 60 days, then the tax court loses jurisdiction. And really, the only way to revisit it would be to file an offer in compromise, doubt as to liability. And you would include in the 656L is the form, and it's doubt as to liability, not collectability. So there's no there's no filing fee, and there's no down payment required, but you have to agree to that you owe something, that you're going to pay something. You can't just say that you owe nothing. So what you would do is provide whatever evidence you have for expenses that you believe you can successfully appeal. And to do that, you would need a proof of the expense, which would be some copy of a statement or an invoice or some kind of bill, and then a copy of the cancel check showing that that invoice, statement, or bill was paid, and then that bill and payment of that bill was for some kind of goods and services that were required for the business. And you would then submit the offer and say, I can't prove some of these expenses, and so that I owe the taxes on those, but these other expenses I can prove, and I think that the liability should be adjusted accordingly. And so when you file the offer doubt as to liability, it gets assigned to an offer specialist, and basically you get another audit, and you get to prove your expenses and get them to adjust the audit accordingly. So that's really what you need to do.
All right, moving on to the next one. This is coming from Carlton, all the way from Texas. How are you doing, Carlton? I have a client who was denied various credits because the IRS said that their records show that he was an inmate in a penal institution for the entire year. Ultimately, a notice of deficiency was issued. A tax court petition was timely filed and went to appeals, who agreed with my client. IRS counsel prepared the judgment saying that my client is due a refund and it had the proper signatures, including the signatures of the judge. We have not been able to get the refund. Is filing a claim for refund the best alternative?
Yeah, it might be. And the reason is that under certain circumstances, the tax court doesn't have the jurisdiction or authority to issue a refund. They can just determine that the taxpayer doesn't owe. And so I'm not sure what the problem with the refund is, but I would put in a claim and I would attach a copy of the judgment that shows that, where the judge signed, that shows that he's entitled to a refund. That's how I would do it. But I think you may run across a thing where they're going to tell you that for one reason or another, I've had a case similar had to do a trust fund recovery penalty, and the tax court didn't have the jurisdiction to order a refund, only to wipe out the taxes. Also, I would need to know, you know, when the when they paid it, it may be beyond the jurisdiction if it's more than 3 years. So I would need to look at that, but I would file a claim, and I would attach the judgment to it, saying that the judgment issued a refund.
All right, Carlton, hopefully that helps you there, point you in the right direction. Next one is coming from Thomas. Thomas is asking, I have an attorney who has not filed personal income tax returns in 5 years. In addition to his tax payments, he'll have penalties and interest. Returns are not completed yet. Can I select the single year with the greatest penalty amount to apply for the first time waiver?
So this is kind of tricky because I think what we're talking about is first time penalty abatement program. And you need to be in current compliance. So I'm not sure if these 5 years returns are the most recent 5 years or not, or if, you know, they're earlier than that and he's been current for the last couple of years. So that would be one question. The other one would be, I know that you want it applied to the year that he owes the most, but they may apply it to the earliest year. So I would just call, because they have a simple program where they ask you a series of questions and you answer them, and then their program would tell you whether or not the taxpayer qualifies for the first-time penalty abatement program. If they do, then they'll issue it right away. If not, they'll send a letter denying the refund, and you can appeal it. So you might want to do that. The other thing is, if they don't qualify for first-time penalty abatement program, they may qualify for abatement under reasonable cause. If you can give a reason why he didn't file for all those years, why they filed late. You know, was he sick? Was there something wrong? Did he think they were filed because his accountant told him that he prepared them and he filed them, but he didn't? I mean, I don't know, but first-time penalty abatement is the easiest way to abate the penalty. If you don't qualify for that, then you need to come up with a reasonable cause argument, and that's the second way of abating the penalties.
All right. Hopefully that helps you there, Thomas. Moving on to Edward. Edward is asking, working on an OIC for a client who is currently in CNC status, will this help or hurt them? Are there any advantages?
I mean, it won't hurt them, but if he's currently not collectible, that's just a temporary status. So I'm not sure with an offer, for currently non-collectible, they're looking at your current financial situation. For an offer, they're looking towards your future financial situation. So the question really is there something happening in the future that is going to increase his income and put him in a better chance to be able to afford to pay his taxes or not? You might want to wait until currently non-collectible is up to 2 years. So you might want to just keep them in currently non-collectible, because remember, while it's in currently non-collectible, the statute for collection is running. And when you file an offer, part of the analysis that they do for the offer is how much could we collect over the life of the statute versus accepting this offer. So if you let the statute run down under the CNC, when you do submit the offer, the analysis is going to be more in the taxpayer's favor, because the IRS will have less time to collect. So I think a better strategy would be to wait until CNC expires and then submit an offer.
That makes sense, running out that clock. All right, moving on to the next one. This is from Virginia. Virginia is asking, my client owns a small family restaurant, S Corporation, and has several employees, but is struggling to make the payroll tax deposits. I know CNC is available for income taxes, but is that also an option for payroll taxes? If so, what can I expect from the IRS when presenting them with the company's financials?
Yeah, I think that's a really hard role. That would be like an in-business, currently non-collectible. But the problem is, number one is that currently non-collectible while they're making their current federal tax deposits, because they have to be current on their federal tax deposits. They have to be current on their payroll tax. So even if they do get in CNC, that's not a license for them to continue operating without paying their payroll tax. So let's say they're making all their payroll tax, they're paying all their payroll tax, they're making all their federal tax deposits, but there's just nothing left over for an installment agreement. Can they be currently non-collectible? Yes, but not for very long. And secondly is they're going to look to responsible persons for the trust fund recovery penalty. And so even if the corp can't pay it, the responsible persons are going to be paying the trust fund portion, which is usually about 50% of the payroll. The thing is, usually payroll tax cases get assigned to revenue officers, even if there's a small amount owed. It's not like individuals where they have to owe more than $250,000 or whatever. So it would really depend on what kind of revenue officer you draw. But in any case, the most important thing to do would be to make all your current federal tax deposits. And when you file your second quarter return at the end of this month that you don't owe, and see if you can get some breathing space for the past liability. But it's kind of tough because the thing is, because the money was withheld from the employees, even if they file a return and they get a refund, the IRS has to honor that refund and pay the employees money that was never submitted to the IRS. So they're really going into their pocket, so to speak, and refunding the employees for taxes that the employer never paid in. So they really don't have much patience for that kind of thing. So you can try, but the only way it's going to work is if you're in current compliance.
All right. And you know what? This is looks like the second question that we have regarding to businesses and payroll taxes. So one of the subjects that we cover on our upcoming event on August 1st is going to be in business offers and compromise, payroll taxes, trust fund recovery penalties, how to deal with these situations and represent your client in the best possible way to help keep their business afloat. A lot of our goals is to make sure that we can help the clients and maintain their business operating. So we do cover that in great depth in the upcoming event on August 1st. You may have heard of it. We probably received an email from us advertising the event coming up August 1st. We're offering it in two different formats. So let me just take this time now to give you guys a little bit of a promo on that. So yes, it is that time again. Our next full day event is right around the corner, with several dates available to accommodate the demand and those professionals in other time zones. So we do keep you in mind when you're on the East Coast, Central Coast, and other coasts. So with this course, you're going to learn to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income. Learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most. Learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. So Tax Resolution Essentials 200A, Intermediate Tax Resolution is being held on August 1st, 8 a.m. Pacific Time, and August 9th, 8 a.m. Eastern, and August 10th, 8 a.m. Central. both live and online. Actually, I'm sorry, let me correct that. The August 1st is the only one that's in person so that you can attend in person. The other ones are going to be rebroadcast. So it's $300 if you want to attend live and in person on August 1st, or online is $250 for any of the other days, so the 1st, 9th, and 10th. And as always, I have a special promo for those of you guys who are attending today's call. Being that tomorrow is the 4th of July, I'm giving you guys a head start on the celebration by offering you $50 off any of the days. That means that you could attend in person for $250 and online for $200. Simply use promo code HAPPY4TH at checkout to receive the discount. I will send you this information in the chat box here right now. I'm going to be pushing that forward, but you will also get it in the follow-up email after the event is done. So please take advantage of this deal. We look forward to seeing you on August 1st, 9th, or 10th for these annual tax resolution essentials, intermediate tax resolution coming up at the end, beginning of next month. So thank you very much and hope to see you there. Now let's go ahead and get back to the other questions.
I just want to say one thing about, and that is, at least here in California, one thing we look at right away when a client owes federal payroll taxes, whether they owe the EDD state payroll tax too. And the EDD is even more aggressive than the IRS. So it's really important for these companies to pay their state and federal payroll tax liabilities, because the state can get very aggressive and levy the bank account without any warning. And that can be really tough when you've got expenses to pay and there's outstanding checks and now there's no way of paying it. So it's really important to, number one, stay or get into compliance, and two, if there's a problem, to go to a professional for help.
Yeah, some of you may have noticed that, these state tax agencies are a lot more aggressive than the IRS. The IRS tends to be a walk in the park. We've had situations where the state sends someone to watch over the register and takes the cash at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's called the keeper.
Yeah, a keeper.
And if they do levy your bank account, the only time that they'll release funds is if you can show that there's outstanding checks for payroll, because they want the employees to get paid. So you'd have to prove that you have outstanding payroll. Otherwise, you know, the rent and everything else can bounce. So it's really important to get in front of this, and that's where professional tax help comes in.
Right. All right. Moving on here, Patty also talking about trust fund recovery penalties. She says, I am taking on a trust fund recovery penalty case and getting ready for a 4180 interview. The IRS wants to meet with the owners and the office manager. The office manager is just an employee and does not have an ownership interest in the corporation. Is there a way to keep the IRS from focusing on him?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's lots of horror stories about employees getting stuck with trust fund recovery penalty if they meet certain criteria. So the 4180 interview is based on the form 4180, which is not a public form available on the IRS website. But if you Google it, you should be able to find one. And there's the newer one is a couple years ago, they updated it. So you want to make sure you get the new one. And on the first page, they go through a series of questions about responsibilities. And they ask, like, who they're interviewing. So they're going to start with the owners. Were you on the bank signatory cards? Did you sign checks? Did you authorize the preparation of checks? Did you authorize payment of creditors? Because the thing the IRS is looking at is, you know, did the company pay its rent and pay its vendors and pay the utilities but not pay the payroll tax liability? So then the IRS figures, well, you know, we should have been paid first, not last. And so they consider any payments to any other creditor other than them to be a default And so they're going to go after individuals to make up the difference. So if they ask, when they go through these questions, if the owners say, yes, I did this, I did that, then they ask, did anybody else have the authority to do this kind of stuff? So if the employee, for instance, was on the bank signature card, could sign checks, could authorize payment to creditors, could authorize payroll, those kinds of stuff, then he's going to be liable and assess the trust fund recovery penalty. If he didn't sign checks, then he's pretty much off the hook. If he did, but only under direct supervision of one of the owners, then he might be able to get out of it by saying he only signed checks, for instance, when the owners weren't in the office, and if a vendor stopped by with a delivery and required payment at the time of delivery, like COD, that the employee had the authority to write the vendor a check and sign it. So you have to look at it, but you really have to kind of prep the owners to go through the 4180, not to put up any flags if there's somebody you want to keep off. But just because he's an employee and doesn't have any ownership interest doesn't automatically take him off the hook. So you have to look at his responsibilities and what his duties were. And the second part of the question is knowledge, is whether he knew when he wrote these checks or signed these checks, whether he had knowledge that the IRS wasn't being paid and these other creditors were. So there's two parts to it. There's the responsibility part and the knowledge part. And that's all on the 4180. Interview. The form is like an interview, and the revenue officer goes through it and fills in the blanks after asking the questions, and then determines who's responsible and who's not.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. And Patty, hopefully that helps you there. Now, I do want to say that you don't have to go to Google for the 4180 form. We have it on our website under the forms library. So just go into taxresolutioninstitute.org. Look up the forms library, and you'll see a sample there that you guys can download, take a look at, print, and kind of do a walkthrough with your client. Okay,
but you won't find it on the IRS website.
Yeah, you won't find it on the IRS website. That's correct. Moving on to next question is for Mark. And, Mark, I read your question, and it is – I'm going to summarize it here real quickly, but just to let you know, it's a tax-related question for preparation, which is best answered by a CPA, which we do not have here today. So these are the type of questions that we'll refer out to one of the CPAs here in our office. But just to let you guys know what it's about, it seems like it's an elder abuse case where a caregiver had taken or stolen money from the elderly individual. So Mark's question relates to the restitution after the person was found guilty and the lost interest and the disbursement from the retirement fund. So there's a lot of questions there with how to treat that on the tax return. And again, Mark, that's one of the things that is best answered by one of our CPAs. So I recommend you sign up for one of our membership packages and schedule some consultation time with them so they can help address that with you. Unfortunately, neither Norman or I are qualified to answer that question. So take a look at it there. Moving on to the next question is from Mary. Mary's asking, client just had some taxes survive his personal bankruptcy because they are recent years, 2015 and 16, and I want to submit an offer for him. The surviving taxes are about $25,000, but he discharged about $60,000. Through the BK, he proved his insolvency. Will the IRS expedite the offer because of this? Anything I should look out for?
Okay, so the answer is the short answer is no, because again the bankruptcy is that the taxpayer is insolvent at the time that he files the bankruptcy petition. And that's determined by his assets versus his liabilities. But the offer is what the future earnings of the taxpayer are. And so somebody could file bankruptcy, for instance, because there's a large judgment against him, or the medical expenses, or a costly divorce, or a house in foreclosure. There could be a lot of reasons for bankruptcy, and it could be insolvent for bankruptcy purposes, but that doesn't necessarily translate into qualifying for an offer. But yeah, he could submit an offer for the surviving taxes. And the other good thing about the discharging taxes in bankruptcy, or discharging any liabilities in bankruptcy, is that it's not a COD income. So cancellation of debt in bankruptcy is not taxable, which isn't always, which isn't true about, like, for instance, settling credit cards for less than you owe, or other settlement of debts can translate into COD income and be taxable. So that's a good thing about the bankruptcy. So you could submit an offer, but you can't submit an offer if you're in bankruptcy. You can't submit an offer if you've gotten your discharge. Also, you want to see that the bankruptcy case is not only discharged, but that the case is closed. Sometimes, for one reason or another, the case is left open, and you really want the case to be closed. So make sure the case is closed. And you submit the 433A OIC and the 656, just like any other offer. And there's a question on the 656 about whether you filed bankruptcy or not. And yes, and when did you file, which district, and did you receive a discharge, and when, and what chapter did you file, and everything. But the bankruptcy by itself doesn't really go to whether or not the offer will be accepted.
Yeah, you still have to go through the motions with them. All right, Mary, hopefully that answers your question. Next one is from Jesse. Jesse's asking, taxpayer tried to negotiate their own installment agreement for a tax liability of $18,000. Taxpayer offered $300 a month, but the IRS denied the request and wants $1,500 a month. There's no way the taxpayer can afford that. Why would the IRS deny this request? I read on your site about the streamlined installment agreement rules, and it says the IRS will accept if the amount is less than $25,000.
Right, so the simple answer is, it doesn't say here what year the taxpayer owes for. And so to qualify for a streamlined installment agreement, let's say it normally, if the taxpayer owed $18,000, they would divide the $18,000 by 72. And, you know, it would come up to a couple hundred dollars a month. So you would think that there'd be no problem. But that would be true, let's say, if the $18,000 was 2017 liability, and the IRS, or let's say 2017 liability, and he filed a return in April, and now it got assessed in May, and now they have 20 years to collect, or 10 years to collect. But what if the tax that he owes $18,000 for is like 9 years ago? And so the IRS only has a year to collect. So they're not going to accept an installment agreement for anything less than would full pay the taxes within the statute for collection as a streamline. Now, if he can't afford that, then he needs to complete a 433F. and show that, you know, $300 a month is all he can afford. But let's say there was a year left on the statute, they would need to get $1,500 a month for a year to pay off the $18,000. So I think that the only thing I could think of a why on a streamline they wouldn't accept the $300 is because the statute on collection would expire before the tax was paid, and so they would need $1,500 a month to pay the liability within a year. So what he needs to do is the streamline doesn't work for that case. So then he needs to do a 433F, and this installment agreement needs to be based on his ability to pay. The other thing to look at is what's the state of collection, because the statute may be expiring soon and the tax becomes uncollectible. So in some cases, it may be best to do nothing.
That's right. And I'm sure the IRS explained this to the taxpayer, but they must have just heard $1,500 and ignored the rest.
Or not. I don't find the IRS particularly helpful in letting the taxpayer know how he can
avoid paying
the tax. So I would try to find out. First, I would want to know what year these taxes are for. Secondly, when does the statute expire? And third, what's his financial ability to pay?
All right. Just so you guys know, we have about 10 minutes left on this call, so go ahead and submit your questions online. We only have a couple more from people that submitted prior to the call. I will be getting to those that submitted online, so please go ahead, submit your questions now. We will be opening it up, and if you're interested in a live call, we can turn that on for you as well. So next question here is from Robbie. Robbie's asking, when preparing an offer in compromise, the only asset the client has is an IRA account for about $50,000, which is his only source of retirement. Taxpayer is 63 years old. Can that amount be excluded based on hardship? What is the best way to handle this problem?
Yeah, so there's three kinds of offers in compromise. One is doubt as to collectability, and that may be a problem here because he has an asset or something. The other is doubt as to liability, which we talked about before, if you dispute that you owe the tax. The third is effective administration, which is saying, yeah, there is an asset, but it shouldn't be included in the analysis because of some special circumstances. So in this case, yeah, the taxpayer is 63, but doesn't say whether he's still working or retired. It doesn't say if he is working, how much money he's making. You know, what if he's a 63-year-old CEO who's making $1 million+ a year? Third, it doesn't say whether there's any other sources of income. So if the IRA was his only source of income, and then I think that the effective administration would be the way to go. But it's not clear here. Well, it says it's his only source of retirement, which isn't really true because wouldn't he also qualify for Social Security? So I'm not sure that would be his only source of retirement. I think he'd also get Social Security retirement, but it doesn't say that it's his only source of income. So it's really impossible to analyze the OIC without knowing what his income is.
So Robbie, yeah, if you want to get us more information, we can give you a little more guidance on that. You can email us or call us and we can help you with that. All right. Again, before we open it up to the rest of you on the line, this is the last question that was pre-submitted. This is from Andy. I have a client that has not filed returns for more than 3 years. I will be preparing and filing the delinquent returns, and we know he will owe a significant amount. Client wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. You mentioned that there is a waiting period in order to do this. What was it, 180 days from filing?
No. So first of all, in order to discharge taxes in bankruptcy, there's three rules. One is the three-year rule. And the three-year rule is that the bankruptcy has to be filed more than 3 years after the due date of the return. So it says here that the client hasn't filed returns for more than 3 years, but it doesn't say which returns. But let's say they're the three most recent, which would be 15, 16, and 17. So the due date of 17 would have been April, let's say April 15th, 2018, if there was no extension. So the thing is, it's not even available for discharge in bankruptcy until after April 15th, 2021. And then let's say he owes for the 3 years of 15, 16, 17. So 15 would have been due in 2016, and the 3 years would expire in 2019. So that's at least a year away. And then the next year, 17 would be, or 16 would be due on 17, so that would be 2020. So he's years away from having a bankruptcy discharge these taxes. The other rule is a two-year rule, and it's 2 years from the date of filing. So even if he filed the prepared the returns now and filed them now, well, for the most recent year, the three-year rule would extend beyond the 2 years, so you wouldn't have to worry. But that earliest year, the 2015, would have been due on in 16, and the 3 years would be up in 2019. But if he filed it now, the two-year rule wouldn't be up until 2020. So he's a minimum of 2 years away from any bankruptcy that would discharge these taxes. And the 180 days is 180 days from assessment. But again, that 180 days after assessment would be dwarfed by the 2 and 3 year rules. So he's looking at being at least 3 years away from filing bankruptcy in order to get rid of all those taxes.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman, for that. So let's move on to Martin. Martin has a question regarding penalties. So a client has been assessed an accuracy-related penalty. What reasons may I use to abate or relieve this penalty? The cause was my fault because I misread the 1099-R form for taxable amounts and withholding from the federal taxes. So it sounds like a
reasonable cause. So it would be that the taxpayer submitted correct documentation to the tax preparer, but the tax preparer made some kind of mistake that created the problem, and you'd want to submit a request for penalty abatement for reasonable cause and state what happened and have a letter from the preparer stating what happened. And that's a 20% penalty too. And so you'd ask that the penalty be abated because the taxpayer submitted correct information. It wasn't his fault. You can try it. And there's no downside to the tax preparer.
So this could be done via a phone call, or do they need to document it somehow?
You need to document it. Okay. You need to send a letter to ACS support in Cincinnati, depending where you live.
All right. Next one is from John. This is a bankruptcy-related question. With the debtor in bankruptcy, can you comment on how taxes are discharged under Chapter 7, 11, and 13? Does the debtor's attorney need to commence an adversary proceeding to discharge the taxes, or is this automatic, or he must contact the IRS, et cetera? Is this process any different for an entity or a non-individual?
Okay, so you submit a bankruptcy petition, and on the petition you've done, before filing the petition, you've done a tax dischargeability analysis, and you've determined that all the taxes are dischargeable. So are they automatically discharged? No, but it could be simple, it could be not so simple. So what I do is, once the debtor received his discharge, I send a letter to IRS bankruptcy unit asking that they abate all the taxes, penalties, and interest because they were discharged in the bankruptcy. If the IRS agrees, then it's pretty simple. They may want to be paid, though, because if they have a lien, that lien has a value. The value of the lien is the value of the debtor's assets. So you want to negotiate an amount that would pay off the lien, and the IRS would release the lien and discharge the taxes. Sometimes if the taxpayer doesn't have anything of particular value, they could release the lien without asking for any money. But sometimes you have to pay them something in order for them to release the lien. If they come back and they go, we're not discharging the taxes for some reason or another, and you think they're wrong, then what you want, then you need to file an adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy to determine that the taxes were discharged. But this is something that the bankruptcy attorney would do. So I'm not sure if you're a bankruptcy attorney or not, but it's something, if a debtor is going to be filing bankruptcy and owes taxes, he should definitely get a bankruptcy attorney who understands tax dischargeability and bankruptcy, and not all or even most or bankruptcy attorneys understand all the tax consequences. So you want to make sure you have a bankruptcy attorney who understands taxes. In a 13, you have to pay the IRS the value of their secured claim. You have to pay them through this Chapter 13 plan the amount of priority debt, which is a priority tax, and a percentage of the general unsecured claim, which the IRS gets paid like all other general unsecured creditors, which is pro rata based on the debtor's disposable income and plan payment, and 11 is similar. So it really depends on what kind of taxes, either secured, unsecured priority, or general unsecured, and the taxpayer's ability to pay. So again, if you're representing a taxpayer who needs a bankruptcy, you need to interview any bankruptcy attorney to make sure that they understand how this works.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. John, hopefully that helps you and guides you a little bit there. We have reached the end of this month's Practitioners Forum, so I want to thank you, everyone, for joining us today. As a reminder, our next one is coming up on August 7th is the next Practitioners Forum. So that's not going to be till after the August 1st event. So we do look forward to seeing you guys there. I just pushed again in the chat box the details for the promotion that we have going on for the August 1st event. Remember, this is a full-day seminar. You get a lot of details, a lot of information on how to do this type of work, and more importantly, how to take care of your clients, how to grow your practice and make more money in the process. So thanks again. Happy 4th to everybody, and we'll see you again soon.